The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 6, Side 2.
Son of the steppes, why couldn't you gallop on your way? What harm had the poor wretch done you? But no, the Kazakh said menacingly, "You sit prison, you go with me." Stepan cursed him and walked on. The Kazakh rode alongside, ordering him to come quietly. Then he galloped off a little way, waving his arm and calling to his fellows. But the steppe was deserted. Son of the steppes, why, oh why, could you not just leave him? You could see that he had hundreds of versts of steppe to cross, with nothing but a bare stick in his hands and without food, so that he would perish anyway. Did you need a kilogram of tea so badly? In the course of that week, living on equal terms with the wild animals, Stepan had grown used to the rustling and hissing sounds of the desert. Suddenly his ear caught a new whistling sound in the air, and he was not mentally aware of his danger, but like an animal, sensed it in the pit of his stomach and leapt to one side. This saved him. The Kazakh, he realized, had tried to lasso him, but he had dodged the noose. Hunting bipeds, a man's life for a kilogram of tea. The Kazakh swore and hauled in his lasso, and Stepan went on, warily taking care not to let his enemy out of his sight. The other rode up closer, coiled his rope, and flung it again. As soon as he had made his throw, Stepan rushed at him, struck him on the head with the stick, and knocked him off his horse. He had barely strength enough for it, but he was fighting for his life. "Here's your reward, friend!" Relentlessly, with all the savagery of one beast goring another, Stepan began beating him, but when he saw blood, he stopped. He took both lasso and whip from the Kazakh and scrambled onto the horse. There was a saddlebag with provisions. Stepan was on the run for quite a while longer, another 2 weeks or so, but everywhere he went he religiously avoided his worst enemies, people, his fellow countrymen. He parted with the horse, tried to swim some river or other, although he couldn't swim. Tried making a raft of rushes, and of course couldn't do that either. He hunted, and got away from some large animal, perhaps a bear, in the dark. Then one day, tormented beyond endurance by hunger, thirst, and fatigue, and the longing for hot food, he made up his mind to enter a lonely yurt and beg something. There was a small enclosure in front of the yurt, with an adobe wall, and when he was already close to it, Stepan belatedly saw two saddled horses standing there, and a young Kazakh in a bemedaled tunic and breeches coming toward him. He had missed his chance to run, and thought he was done for. The Kazakh had stepped outside for a breather. He was very drunk, was delighted to see Stepan, and seemed not to notice his tattered and scarcely human appearance. "Come in, come in, be our guest!" Inside the yurt sat an identical young Kazakh with medals, and an old man. The two brothers, who had seen service at the front, were now both important people in Alma-Ata, and had borrowed horses from a Kolkhoz to gallop over and pay their respects to their father and his yurt. These two young fellows had tasted war, and it had made human beings of them. Besides, they were drunk and bursting with drunken good nature. That good nature which, though he made it his business to do so, the great Stalin never fully succeeded in eradicating. They were happy that another guest had joined the feast, though he was only a simple mine worker on his way to Orsk, where his wife was expecting a baby at any moment. They did not ask to see his papers, but gave him food and drink and a place to sleep. That sort of thing sometimes happens, too. Is drink always man's enemy? Does it not sometimes bring out the best in him? Stepan woke up before his hosts, and fearing a trap in spite of everything, he went out. No, both horses were just where they had been, and he could have galloped off on one of them immediately. But he was not the man to harm kind people, and he left on foot. After a few more days walking, he started meeting cars and lorries. He was always quick enough to get out of their way. At last, he reached a railway line and followed it until that same night he found himself near Orsk station. All he had to do was board a train. He had won. He had performed a miracle, crossed a vast expanse of desert all alone, with nothing but a homemade knife and a stick, and now he had reached his goal. Suddenly, By the light of the station lamps, he saw soldiers pacing along the tracks. So he continued on foot along a cart track parallel with the railway line. He no longer troubled to hide, even when morning came, because he was in Russia now, his native land. A cloud of dust came toward him, and for the first time Stepan did not run away from a car. Out of this first real Russian car jumped a real Russian militiaman. "Who are you? Show me your papers." Stepan explained that he was a tractor driver looking for work. As it happened, a Kolkhoz chairman was with the militiaman. "Let him be. I desperately need tractor drivers. How many people have papers down on the farm?" They traveled all day, haggling as they went, stopping for drinks and snacks. But just before nightfall, Stepan couldn't stand any more and ran for the woods, which were some 200 meters away. The militiaman rose to the occasion and fired. Fired again. Stepan had to stop. They tied him up. It may well be that his trail was cold, that they'd given him up for dead, that the soldiers at Orsk had been lying in wait for somebody else, because the militiaman was for releasing him. And at the district MVD station they made a great fuss over him to begin with, gave him tea and sandwiches and Kazbek cigarettes. And the commandant questioned him in person, addressing him politely. "You never know with these spies. He'll be taken to Moscow tomorrow, and might easily lodge a complaint." "Where's your transmitter? Been dropped here to make a map or two, have you? Which service are you with?" Stepan was puzzled. "I've never worked in the geological service. I'm more of a miner." This escape ended with something worse than sandwiches or even physical capture. When he got back to the camp, he was beaten lengthily and unmercifully. Worn out and broken by all his sufferings, Stepan fell lower than ever before. He signed on with the Kengir security officer Belyaev to help him flush out would-be escapers. He became a sort of decoy duck. He gave one or two cellmates in the Kengir jail a detailed account of his escape and watched their reactions. If there was any response, any obvious hankering to repeat the attempt, Stepan Blank reported it to the Godfather. The incidental cruelties which mark any difficult escape attempt were seen vividly enlarged in a bloody and confused breakout, also from Jez Kazgan, and also in summer 1951. 6 prisoners escaping by night from a pit began by killing a 7th, whom they believed to be a stool pigeon. Then they climbed an old prospecting shaft out onto the steppe. The 6 prisoners included people of very different stripe, and they immediately decided to separate. This would have been the right thing to do, if only they had had a sensible plan. But one of them went straight to the settlement where the free workers lived, right next to the camp, and knocked on the window of his woman friend. His intention was not to hide, to wait a while under the floorboards or in the attic. That would have been very sensible. But simply to have a good time with her while it lasted. We recognize at once the characteristics of the professional criminal. He whooped it up for a day and a night, and then the following evening put on her former husband's suit and took her to a film show in the club. Some of the jailers from the camp were there, recognized him, and collared him immediately. 2 of the others, Georgians, thoughtlessly sure of themselves, walked to the station and got on the train to Karaganda. But from Jez Kazgan, apart from cattle trails and escapers' trails, there is no other way through to the outside world except this one, toward Karaganda and by train. Along the line there are camps, and at every station there is a security post, so that they were both collared before they reached Karaganda. The other 3 took the most difficult road, to the southwest. There were no people, but there was no water either. The elderly Ukrainian, Prokopenko, who had seen active service, had a map and persuaded them to choose this route, telling them that he would find them water. His companions were a Crimean Tatar, turned into a criminal by the camps, and a foul, bitching thief. They went on for 4 days and nights without food or water. When they could stand it no longer, the Tatar and the thief told Prokopenko, "We've decided to finish with you." He didn't understand. "What do you mean, pals? Do you want to go your own way?" "No, to finish you. We can't all get through." Prokopenko started pleading with them. He slit the lining of his cap and took out a photograph of his wife and children, hoping to stir their pity. "Brothers, brothers, I thought we were all on our way to freedom together. I'll get you through. There should be a well soon. There's bound to be water. Hang on a bit. Have some mercy." but they stabbed him to death, hoping to quench their thirst with his blood. They cut his veins, but the blood wouldn't flow. It had curdled immediately. Another striking scene. Two men bending over another on the step, wondering why he wouldn't bleed. Eyeing each other like wolves, because now one of them must die, they went on in the direction which the old boy had pointed out to them, and 2 hours later found a well. The very next day they were sighted from a plane and captured. They admitted it all under interrogation. The camp got to know about it, and decided to avenge Prokopenko by knocking off the pair of them. But they were kept in a separate cell and taken elsewhere for trial. You may believe, if you wish, that everything depends on the stars under which an escape begins. Your plans have been laid, oh, so carefully, so very long in advance. But then at the crucial moment the lights go out in the compound and your chance of seizing a lorry goes up in smoke. Whereas sometimes, when an attempt is made on the spur of the moment, circumstances fall into place as though made to order. In summer 1948, in Jezkazgan again, 1st Division, not yet a special camp, a dump truck was detailed one morning to take on a load of sand at a quarry some distance away and deliver it to the cement mixers. The sandpit was not a work site, which meant that it was not guarded and that the loaders, three long-sentence prisoners, one serving a tenner, the other two quarters, had to be taken on the lorry. Their escort consisted of a lance corporal and two soldiers, and the driver was a non-political offender, a trustee. Here was a chance, but chances must be seized as quickly as they arrive. A decision had to be taken, and a plan concerted, all in sight and hearing of the guards who stood by while the sand was loaded. The biographies of all three were identical, and like those of millions at that time. First the front, then German prisoner of war camps, escape, recapture, punitive concentration camps, liberation when the war ended, and, by way of thanks for it all, imprisonment by their own side. They hadn't been afraid to flee across Germany. What could stop them from trying it at home? They finished loading. The corporal took his seat in the cab. The two soldiers sat to the front of the lorry, backs to the cab, with their Tommy guns trained on the convicts, who sat on the sand to the rear. As soon as they drove out of the quarry, the prisoners exchanged signals, threw sand in the eyes of the guards, and piled on top of them. They took away their Tommy guns and stunned the corporal with a blow from a gun butt through the cab window. The lorry stopped. The driver was almost dead with fright. "Don't be afraid," they told him. "We won't hurt you. You aren't one of those dogs. Dump your load." The engine raced, and the sand, that precious sand, worth more than its weight in gold because it had brought them freedom, poured onto the ground. Here, too, as in almost all escapes, let history not forget it, the slaves showed themselves more generous than their guards, didn't kill them, didn't beat them up, merely ordered them to remove their clothes and their boots and released them in their underwear. "What about you, driver? Are you with us or with them?" "You, of course. What do you think?" the driver decided. To confuse the barefooted guards, this was the price of their clemency, they drove first to the west. On the flat step you can drive where you like. Then one of them changed into the corporal's clothes, and the other two into those of the soldiers, and they sped northward. They were all armed. The driver had a pass, no one could suspect them. All the same, whenever their path crossed a telegraph route, they broke the wires to disrupt communications. They tied a stone to a rope, slung it over the wires to weigh them down, then tugged at them with a hook. This took time, but gained them more in the end. They tore on at full speed all day long until the odometer had clocked up 300 kilometers and the petrol gauge registered zero. They began sizing up passing cars. A pobeda came along. They stopped it. "Sorry, comrade, we're only doing our duty. Please let me see your papers." VIPs, they turned out to be, district party bosses visiting their kolkhozes to inspect, inspire, or maybe just to eat beshbarmak. "Right, out you get. Strip!" "Don't shoot us," the big boys implored. The escapers led them out on the step, tied them up, took their documents, and rolled off in the pobeda. It was not till evening that the soldiers whom they had stripped earlier in the day reached the nearest pit, only to hear from the watchtower, "Don't come any nearer. We're soldiers like you." "Oh, no, you aren't. Not while you're walking around in your underpants." As it happened, the pobeda's tank wasn't full. When they had driven about 200 kilometers, the petrol ran out, and there was nothing in the jerry can either. It was getting dark by then. They saw some horses grazing, managed to catch them, although they had no bridles, and galloped bareback. The driver fell from his horse and hurt his leg. They suggested that he get up behind another rider. He refused. "Don't be afraid, lads, I won't rat on you." They gave him some money and the papers from the Pobeda and galloped away. After the driver, no one ever saw them again. They were never taken back to their camp. And so the lads had left their quarters and their 10 no change behind in the security officer's safe. The green prosecutor favours the bold. The driver kept his word and did not give them away. He fixed himself up in a kolkhoz near Petropavlovsk and lived in peace for 4 years. Love of art was his undoing. A good accordionist, he performed in the Kolkhoz Club, then competed at amateur festivals, first in the district centre, then in the provincial capital. He himself had practically forgotten his former life, but one of the Jez Kazgan jailers was in the audience and recognised him. He was arrested as soon as he left the stage, and this time they slapped 25 years on him under Article 58. He was sent back to Jez Kazgan. In a category of their own, we must put those escapes which originate not in a despairing impulse, but in technical calculations and the love of fine workmanship. A celebrated scheme for escaping by rail was conceived in Kangir. Freight trains carrying cement or asbestos were regularly pulled in at one of the work sites for unloading. They were unloaded within the restricted area and left empty. And 5 convicts planned their escape as follows. They made a false end wall for a heavy boxcar, and what is more, hinged it like a folding screen, so that when they dragged it up to the car it looked like nothing more than a wide ramp, convenient for wheelbarrows. The plan was this. While the boxcar was being unloaded, the convicts were in charge of it. They would haul their contraption inside and open it out, clamp it to the solid side of the boxcar, stand, all 5 of them, with their backs to the wall, and raise the false wall into position with ropes. The box car was completely covered with asbestos dust, and so was the board. A casual eye would not see the difference in the box car's depth. But the timing was tricky. They had to finish unloading the train, ready for its departure, while the convicts were still on the work site. But they couldn't board it too soon. They must be sure that they would be moved immediately. They were making their last-minute rush, complete with knives and provisions, and suddenly one of the escapers caught his foot in a switch and broke a leg. This held them up, and they didn't have time to complete the installation before the guards checked the train. So they were discovered. A full-dress investigation and trial followed. However, my ward-mate in the Tashkent Cancer Clinic, an Uzbek camp guard, told me that this attempt, of which he spoke with reluctant admiration, had in fact succeeded. The same idea was adopted by trainee pilot Batanov in a single-handed attempt. Door frames were made at the Ekibastuds woodworks for delivery to building sites. Work at the plant went on all around the clock, and the guards never left the towers. But at the building sites, a guard was mounted only in the daytime. With the help of friends, Batanov was boarded up with a frame, loaded onto a lorry, and unloaded at a building site. His friends, back at the woodworks, muddled the count when the next shift came on, so that he was not missed that evening. At the building site, he released himself from his box and walked away. However, he was seized that same night on the road to Pavlodar. This was a year after his other attempt when they punctured a tire as he was escaping in a car. Escapes successful and escapes frustrated at the start. Events which were already making the ground hot underfoot. The deeply thought-out disciplinary decisions of prison officers, sit-down strikes and other forms of defiance, these were the reasons why the ranks of the disciplinary brigade at Ekibastuts swelled steadily. The 2 stone wings of the prison and the disciplinary barracks, hut number 2 near the staff building, could no longer hold them. Another disciplinary barracks was established, hut number 8, specially for the banderists. After every fresh escape and every fresh disturbance, the regime in all 3 special sections became more and more severe. For the historian of the criminal world, we may note that the bitches in the Ekibastuts camp jail grumbled about it. "Bastards, time you gave up this escaping. Because you keep trying to escape, they won't let us breathe any more. You can get your mug bashed in for this sort of thing in an ordinary camp." In other words, they said what the bosses wanted them to say. In summer 1951, Disciplinary Barracks No. 8 took it into their heads to escape altogether. They were about 30 metres from the camp boundary and made up their minds to tunnel. But too many tongues wagged, and the Ukrainian lads discussed it almost openly among themselves, never thinking that any member of the Bandera army could be an informer, but some of them were. Their tunnel was only a few metres long when they were sold. The leaders of Disciplinary Barracks No. 2 were greatly vexed by this noisy stunt, not because they feared reprisals, as the bitches did, but because they, too, were only 30 metres from the fence, and had planned and made a start on a high-class tunnel before Hut No. 8. Now they were afraid that if the same thought had occurred to both Disciplinary Barracks, the dog pack would realise it and check. But the Ekipastut's bosses were more afraid of escapes in vehicles, and made it their chief concern to dig trenches a metre deep around all the work sites and the living area, so that any vehicle trying to leave would plunge into them. As in the Middle Ages, walls were not enough, and moats, too, were needed. An excavator neatly and accurately scooped out trenches of this kind, one after another, around all the sites. Disciplinary Barracks No. 2 was a small compound hemmed in with barbed wire inside the big Ekibastut's compound. Its gate was always locked. Apart from the time spent at the lime kilns, the disciplinary regime prisoners were allowed outside only for 20 minutes' exercise in their little yard. For the rest of the time, they were locked up in their barracks and crossed the main compound only to and from work lineup. They were not allowed into the general mess hall at all. The cooks brought food to them in mess tins. As far as they were concerned, the lime kilns were a chance to enjoy the sun and rest a bit, and they took care not to overstrain themselves shoveling noxious lime. When on top of this a murder took place at the end of August 1951, the criminal Aspanov killed the escaper Anikin with a crowbar. Anikin had crossed the wire with the help of a snowdrift during a blizzard, but had been recaptured a day later, which was why he was in the disciplinary barracks. See also Part 3, Chapter 14. The Mining Trust refused to have any more to do with such workers, and throughout September the disciplinary regime prisoners were not marched out at all, but lived as if in a regular prison. There were many committed escapers among them, and in summer 12 well-matched men had gradually come together in a safe escape team. Mohammed Gadzhiev, leader of the Muslims in Ekibastuts, Vasily Kustarnikov, Vasily Bryukhin, Valentin Ryshkov, Mutyanov, a Polish officer who made a hobby of tunneling, and others. They were equals, but Stepan Konovalov, a Cossack from the Kuban, was nonetheless the leading spirit. They sealed their compact with an oath. If any of them blabbed to a living soul, his number was up. Either he would finish himself off, or the others would stick their knives in him. By then, the Ekibastut's compound was already surrounded by a solid board fence 4 meters high. A belt of ploughed land 4 meters wide followed the fence, and outside it, a 15-meter forbidden area had been marked off, ending in a trench 1 meter deep. They resolved to dig a tunnel under this whole defense zone, so carefully concealed that it could not possibly be discovered before their escape. A preliminary inspection showed that the barracks had shallow foundations, and that with so little space under the floorboards, there would be nowhere to put the excavated soil. The problem seemed insurmountable, should they give up the idea of escaping. Then someone remarked that there was plenty of room in the loft, and suggested hoisting the soil up into it. At first thought, it wasn't worth considering. Raise dozens and dozens of cubic meters of earth into the rafters, without attracting attention, through the living space of the barracks, which was constantly under observation, regularly inspected, raise it daily, hourly, and of course without spilling the merest pinch for fear of giving themselves away. But when they thought of a way to do it, they were overjoyed, and their decision to escape was final. What helped them to decide was their choice of a section, meaning a room. Their Finnish hut, originally intended for free workers, had been erected in the compound by mistake, and there wasn't another like it anywhere in the camp. It had small rooms with 3 bunk beds wedged into each of them, not seven, as everywhere else, so that each held 12 men. They selected a section in which some of their number were already living. By various means, voluntary exchanges, forcing out unwanted roommates, teasing and ridiculing them. You snore too loud and you... too much. They shunted outsiders to other sections and brought their own team together. The more strictly the disciplinary barracks prisoners were segregated from the camp at large, the more severely they were punished and bullied, the higher their moral standing in the camps became. Any request from the prisoners in the disciplinary barracks held the force of law for all in the camps. They now started ordering whatever technical aids they needed, and these were made on one or another of the work sites, carried at some risk past the frisking points, and passed with further risk on to the disciplinary barracks, in the dishwash soup, in a loaf of bread, or with the medicines. The first things ordered and delivered were knives and whetstones, then nails, screws, putty, cement, whitening, electric wire, casters. They neatly sawed through the grooved ends of three floorboards with their knives, removed the skirting board which held them down, drew the nails from the butt ends of these boards near the wall, and the nails which fastened them to a joist in the middle of the room. The three loosened planks they fastened widthwise to a lath underneath them, so that they formed a single slab. The main nail was driven into this lath from above. Its broad head was smeared with putty the same colour as the floor, and dusted over. The slab fitted snugly into the floor, and there was no way of getting a hold on it, but they never once pried it up by inserting an axe between the cracks. The way to raise the slab was to remove the skirting board, slip a piece of wire into the little gap around the broad head of the nail, and pull. Every time the tunnelers changed shifts, the skirting board was replaced and taken out all over again. Every day they washed the floor, soaking the floorboards to make them swell and close up chinks or cracks. This entrance problem was one of the most important. The tunnelling room was always kept particularly clean and in exemplary order. Nobody lay on a bunk with his shoes on. Nobody smoked. Objects were not scattered around. There were no crumbs in the lockers. Nowhere was there less reason for an inspecting officer to linger. Very civilized. And on he went. The second problem was that of the lift from the ground to the loft. The tunnelling section, like all the others, had a stove. A narrow space into which a man could just about squeeze had been left between stove and wall. The idea they had was to block up this space, transfer it from the living area to the tunnelling area. In an unoccupied section, they dismantled completely one of the bunks. They used these planks to board up the gap, immediately covered them with lath and plaster, which they then whitewashed to match the stove. Could the warders remember in which of 20 little rooms in the barracks the stove was flush with the wall, and in which it stood out a little? In fact, they didn't even spot the disappearance of the bunk bed. The one thing the jailers might have noticed in the first day or two was the wet plaster, but to do so they would have had to go around the stove and crouch over a bunk, and there was no point in this because the section was in exemplary condition. Even if they had been caught out in this, it need not have meant that the tunnelling operation had failed. This was merely work they had done to beautify that section. The gap was always so dusty and spoiled its appearance. Only when the plaster and whitewash had dried out were the floor and ceiling of the now enclosed niche sawn through with knives and a stepladder knocked together from the same cannibalized bunk bed placed there, so that the shallow space under the floor was connected with the spacious bower in the roof. It was a mine shaft, cut off from the gaze of their jailers, and the only mine for years in which these strong young men had felt like working themselves into a lather. Can any work in a prison camp merge with your dreams, absorb your whole soul, rob you of sleep? It can, but only the work you do to escape. The next problem was that of digging. They must dig with knives and keep them sharp, so much was obvious. But this still left many other problems. For one thing, the mine surveyor's calculations, engineer Mutyanov, you must go down deep enough for safety, but no farther than was necessary, must take the shortest route, must determine the optimum cross-section for the tunnel, must always know where you are, and fix the right point of exit. Then again, the organization of shifts. You must dig as many hours as possible in every 24, but without too many changes of shift, and taking care to be all present and impeccably correct at morning and evening inspections. Then there were working clothes to be thought of, and washing arrangements. You couldn't come up to the surface bedaubed with clay. Then the question of lighting. How could you drive a tunnel 60 meters long in the dark? They ran a wire under the floor and along the tunnel, and still had to find a way to connect it up inconspicuously. Then there must be a signal system. How did you recall the man digging at the far end of the tunnel and out of hearing if someone entered the barracks unexpectedly? And how could the tunnellers safely signal that they must come out immediately? The strictness of the disciplinary barracks routine was also its weakness. The jailers could not creep up on the barracks and descend unexpectedly. They always had to follow the same path between the barbed wire entanglements to the gate, undo the lock, then walk to the barracks and undo another lock, rattle the bolt. All their movements could easily be observed, not, it is true, from the window of the tunnelling room, but from that of the empty cabin by the entrance. All they had to do was to keep an observer there. Signals to the working force were given by lamps. Two blinks meant caution, prepare to evacuate. Repeated blinks meant danger, red alert, hop out quickly. Before they went under the floor, they stripped naked, putting all their clothes under pillows or under a mattress as they took them off. Once past the trapdoor, they slipped through a narrow aperture beyond which no one would have supposed that there could be a wider chamber, where a light bulb burned continually and working jackets and trousers were laid out. Four others, naked and dirty, the retiring shift, scrambled up above and washed themselves thoroughly. The clay hardened in little balls on their body hair and had to be soaked off or pulled away with the hair. All this work was already in progress when the careless tunnelling operation from Disciplinary Barracks No. 8 was discovered. You can easily understand the annoyance, or rather the outrage, of the artists whose ingenious conception had been so insulted. But nothing disastrous happened. At the beginning of September, after nearly a year in prison, Tenno and Zhdanok were returned, to this disciplinary barracks. As soon as he got his breath back, Tenno became restless. He must plan his escape. But however he reproached them with letting the best season for escape slip by, with sitting around and doing nothing, no one in the disciplinary barracks, not even the most committed and desperate escapers, reacted. The tunnellers had 3 4-man shifts, and a 13th man, whoever he might be, was of no use to them. Then Tenno, without beating about the bush, suggested tunnelling, and they replied that they had already thought of it, but that the foundations were too shallow. This was heartless, of course, looking into the eager face of a proven escaper and apathetically shaking your head is like forbidding a clever hunting dog to sniff out game. But Tenno knew these lads too well to believe in this epidemic of indifference. They couldn't all have gone rotten at once. So he and Zhdanok kept them under keen and expert observation, something of which the warders were incapable. Tenno noticed that the lads often went for a smoke to the same cabin near the entrance, always one at a time, never in company. That the door of their section was always on the hook in the daytime. That if you knocked, they didn't open immediately, and that some of them would be sound asleep, as though the nights weren't long enough. Or else Vaska Bryukin would come out all wet from the room where the clothes stool was kept. What are you up to? Just thought I'd have a wash. They were digging, no doubt about it, but where? Why wouldn't they tell him? Tenno went first to one, then to another, and tried bluff. You ought to be more careful about it, lads. It doesn't matter if I spot you digging, but what if an informer does? In the end, they had a confab and agreed to take in Tenno and 3 suitable companions. They invited him to inspect the room and see if he could find any traces. Tenno felt and sniffed every inch of wall and floorboard and found nothing, to his delight and the delight of all the lads. Trembling with joy, he slid under the floor to work for himself. The shift underground was deployed as follows. One man, lying down, picked away at the face. Another, crouching behind him, stuffed the loose earth into small canvas bags especially made for the purpose. A third, on all fours, dragged the bags backward along the tunnel, by means of straps over his shoulders, then went under the floor to the shaft and attached them one by one to a hook lowered from the loft. The fourth man was up there. He threw down the empty bags, hauled up the full ones, carried them, treading lightly, to different parts of the attic, scattered their contents in a thin layer over the whole area, and at the end of the shift covered this soil with cinders, of which there were a lot in the loft. The team might change jobs in the course of the shift, but did not always do so because not everyone could perform the heaviest, utterly exhausting jobs, digging and dragging the soil away. To begin with, they dragged two bags at a time, but then they made it four. For this purpose, they finagled a wooden tray from the cook's, which they towed along with the sacks on it. The strap went around the neck from behind, then passed under the armpits. Necks were rubbed raw, shoulders ached, knees were bruised. After a single trip, a man was in a lather, and after a whole shift, you could pour him into a jug. The digging had to be done in a very uncomfortable position. There was a short-handled shovel, which they sharpened every time. With this, they had to cut vertical grooves to the depth of a bayonet thrust. Then, semi-recumbent with their backs against the fresh-dug earth, they had to gouge lumps of earth and throw them over their shoulders. The soil was sometimes stony, sometimes stiff clay. They had to go around the biggest stones, making a bend in the tunnel. An 8 to 10 hour shift added not more than 2 meters lengthwise, and sometimes less than a meter. The worst of it was the lack of air in the tunnel. Your head swam, you fainted, you felt sick. So yet another problem had to be solved, that of ventilation. Air holes could be bored only upward, into that most dangerous area near the boundary fence, which was under constant surveillance. But without them, breathing was impossible. They ordered a steel propeller blade, fixed a stick to it crosswise, so that they had something like a carpenter's brace, and bored their first hole to the wide world outside. A draft was created, and breathing was easier. When the tunnel went beyond the fence and outside the camp, they made another hole. They were forever sharing their experience, advising each other how best to do things, and reckoning up how far they had gone. The escape hole, or tunnel, plunged under the foundation wall, and from then on diverged from the straight only to avoid stones or because of inaccurate digging. It was half a meter wide and 90 centimeters high, and it had a vaulted roof. Its top, according to their calculations, was about 1.3 or 1.4 meters from the surface. The sides of the tunnel were reinforced with planks, and as they advanced, the electric cable was extended, and more electric bulbs were hung up. If you looked along it, it was like an underground railway, a gulag metro. By now, the tunnel had gone some dozens of meters, and they were digging beyond the boundary fence. Overhead, the tramp of guards on their rounds and the barking and whining of dogs could be clearly heard. When suddenly, one day suddenly, after morning inspection, before the day shift had gone below, and, according to the team's strict rules, while nothing incriminating was visible, they saw a pack of jailers walking toward the barracks, with the short and short-tempered chief prison officer, Lieutenant Machakovsky, at their head. The escapers' hearts sank. Had they been detected? Had they been sold? Or was it just a random check? An order rang out. Collect your personal belongings! Out! Out of the barracks, every last man! The order was obeyed. All the prisoners were driven out and squatted on their haunches in the little exercise yard. From inside, dull thuds were heard. They were stripping the planks from the bunks. "Get your tools in here!" Machakovsky yelled, and the jailers dragged in their crowbars and axes. They could hear boards creaking and groaning as they were ripped up. Such is the fate of the escaper. Not only would all their cleverness, their work, their hopes, their excitement go for nothing, but it would mean the punishment cells again, beatings, interrogations, fresh sentences. However, neither Machakovsky nor any of the jailers ran out waving their arms in savage glee. They came out perspiring, brushing off dirt and dust, panting, not a bit pleased to have done all that donkey work in vain. A half-hearted order, "Step up, one at a time. a search of personal belongings began. The prisoners returned to the barracks. What a shambles! The floor had been taken up in several places, where the boards had been badly nailed down or there were obvious cracks. In the sections, everything had been tossed around, and even the bunks had been spitefully tipped over. Only in the civilized section had nothing been disturbed. Prisoners not in on the secret were outraged. Why can't they sit still, the dogs? What do they think they're looking for? The escapers realized now how clever they had been not to stack piles of soil under the floor. They would have been spotted at once through the gaps in the boards. Whereas no one had climbed into the loft, you could only escape from the loft with wings. In any case, everything up there was carefully covered with cinders. The dogs hadn't nosed out the game. What joy! If you work stubbornly and keep a close watch on yourself, you are bound to reap your reward. Now we know we shall finish the job. There were 6 or 8 meters to go to the circular trench. The last few meters had to be dug with special precision so that the tunnel would come out at the bottom of the trench, neither higher nor lower. What then? Konovalov, Mutyanov, Gadzhiev, and Tenno had by now worked out a plan to which the other 12 agreed. The escape would be in the evening at about 10 o'clock, when the evening inspection had been carried out throughout the camp. The jailers had dispersed to their homes or gone off to the staff hut. The sentries had been relieved on the watchtowers, and the changing of the guard was over. They would go down into the underground passage one by one. The last man would watch the camp grounds from the cabin till the others were down. Then he and the last but one would nail the removable part of the skirting board firmly to the boards of the trapdoor, so that when they let it fall behind them, the skirting board also would fit into place. The broad-headed nail would be drawn downward till it would go no further, and in addition to all this, bolts would be ready under the floor to fasten the trapdoor, so that it would not budge even if anyone tried to wrench it upward. Another thing, before escaping, they would remove the grating from one of the corridor windows. The warders, finding 16 men missing at morning inspection, would not immediately conclude that they had tunneled their way out, but would rush to search the compound, thinking that the disciplinary barracks prisoners had gone to settle accounts with informers. They would also look in the other camp area, in case the missing men had climbed over the wall into it. It was a beautiful job. They'd never find the tunnel. There were no tracks under the window, and 16 men had gone, carried by angels up to heaven. They would crawl out into the peripheral trench, then creep along the bottom away from the watchtower. The exit from the tunnel was too close to it. They would go out to the road one by one. They would leave intervals between groups of four to avoid arousing suspicion and to give themselves time to look around. The last man would take another precaution. He would close the escape hole from outside with a wooden manhole cover smeared with clay, pressing it home with the weight of his body, and then covering it with earth, so that in the morning it would be impossible to discover any trace of a tunnel from the trench either. They would go through the settlement in groups, making loud, carefree jokes. If there should be any attempt to stop them, they would all join in resisting it, with knives if need be. The General Assembly Point was a railway crossing much used by motor vehicles. There was a hump in the road where it crossed the tracks, and they would all lie on the ground nearby without being seen. The crossing was rough. They had seen it and walked over it on their way to work. The boards had been laid any old way, and lorries, whether carrying coal or empty, struggled across it slowly. Two men would raise their hands to stop a lorry as it was leaving the crossing and approach the driver's cab from both sides. They would ask for a lift. At night, drivers were more often than not alone. If this one was, they would immediately draw their knives, overpower him, and make him sit in the middle, while Valka Ryzhov took the wheel. All the others hopped into the back and, full speed ahead to Pavlodar. They would certainly put 130 or 140 kilometers behind them in a few hours. They would turn off upstream before they reached the ferry. Their eyes had not been idle when they were first brought to these parts. Tie the driver up and leave him lying in the bushes. Abandon the lorry, row across the Irtysh, split up into groups, and go their different ways. The grain crop was being taken into storage just then, and all the roads were full of lorries. This book is continued on Cassette 7, Side 1.